Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
You know, usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there is this expectation of precision. It is like engineering.
Right. Very binary.
Exactly. You break your arm, the x-ray shows that stark, jagged white line across the bone, and the doctor just points and says, you know, there it is. That is the problem. It is broken or not broken. It is a clean assessment.
It is deeply comforting to have that kind of clarity. I mean, as human beings, we naturally gravitate toward things that are visible, things that can be neatly categorized, and problems that present an immediately obvious solution.
But then you step into the world of the human mind. You step into our deepest psychological and, well, spiritual neuroses. The intricate patterns of behavior we repeat endlessly, the subtle, almost invisible ways we cause harm to ourselves and to the people around us.
Yeah, the x-ray machine does not work there.
It is entirely useless. We are looking at a diagnostic landscape that is incredibly murky. It becomes profoundly difficult to pinpoint the exact origin point where our suffering begins, let alone, you know, figure out how to cleanly extract it.
That is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. When we truly examine our own consciousness, we find there is no single jagged line to point to. There is, instead, a vast accumulation. It is an intricate, almost overwhelming web of causes, historical conditions, fleeting intentions, and deeply ingrained reactions.
And that vast, intricate web is exactly where we are stepping today. Welcome to this deep dive into the source material. We have a very special mission for our time together today. We are stepping into the profound, measured, and truly transformative space of a Dharma teaching.
We are.
Our goal is to give you, the listener, the time, the breathing room, and the mental space to truly absorb the profound philosophy we are about to explore.
And we are approaching this material not merely as an academic exercise. We approach this as senior practitioners presenting the Dharma. We do this with clarity, with reverence, and with a deep respect for the continuous lineage that has preserved these exact teachings across countless generations.
Right. And the specific focus for our deep dive today is a magnificent canonical Buddhist text from the Tibetan Buddhist canon. It is titled The Dedication Fulfilling All Aspirations. And we have the immense privilege of studying a translation provided by the 84,000 Project.
A truly incredible organization.
It really is. For those who might not be familiar, 84,000. Translating the words of the Buddha is a remarkable global nonprofit initiative. Their mission is breathtaking in its scope. They are working to translate the entirety of the Buddha's words into modern languages and make them freely available to everyone.
It is a monumental undertaking of cultural and spiritual preservation. The specific English translation we are studying today was meticulously completed by Zisusa Major, working in collaboration with Karma Dorje, Beata Kakas, and Nathaniel Rich, all under the patronage and rigorous scholarly supervision of 84,000. It is through their linguistic dedication that we can access the precise mechanics of this text today.
So, what exactly is this text we're holding up to the light? At its core, the dedication fulfilling all aspirations is a prayer. It is a highly structured liturgy meant to be recited.
Yes, to be spoken aloud.
Exactly. Our journey today will unfold systematically, though not like a simple table of contents. First, we need to unravel the fascinating, somewhat mysterious origins of this work, where it sits in the vast library of the Buddhist canon. From there, we will walk carefully through the text's two massive, sweeping movements.
The confession and the rejoicing.
Right. We will look at a profound confession of faults, which is then immediately followed by an expansive, almost cosmic act of rejoicing and the dedication of merit.
I think it is vital to establish right at the beginning why this matters, because to a modern ear, an ancient Tibetan liturgy might sound like a historical artifact, like something kept behind glass, but it is not.
No, not at all. And I want to speak directly to you, the listener, about this. You might be navigating a very modern, very busy life. You are dealing with emails, traffic, complex relationships. Why does this ancient prayer matter to you?
That is the core question.
It matters because the psychological and spiritual mechanics embedded in this text offer a highly refined technology for the mind. It provides a profound framework for how to take radical, unsparing accountability for your past, how to completely clear out the vessel of your mind, and then, crucially, how to direct your highest, most pure intentions for the future.
Yes.
It is a map for pulling ourselves out of those muddy waters of suffering and stepping into absolute clarity.
It truly is a map. But to understand how to read this map, we first need to look at its geography. Before we examine the specific words of the text, we must understand exactly where it sits in the vast library of Buddhist teachings. Because in the Tibetan canon, the placement of a text tells us a great deal about its function and how it was historically meant to be used by practitioners.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the very first thing we notice about this text is what it is distinctly missing. It lacks the typical defining features of a sutra.
Right, the narrative framing.
Exactly. Usually when we open a classical sutra, we expect to see a very specific opening formula. We expect the words, "Thus did I hear." We expect an introductory passage that sets a physical scene, perhaps telling us where the Buddha was residing at that moment, like Vulture Peak or the Jeddah Grove.
And we usually get a very detailed list of the audience.
Right. The monks, the bodhisattvas, the lay people, the gods all gathered around to listen to the discourse.
But the dedication, fulfilling all aspirations, has absolutely none of that narrative architecture. It plunges straight, immediately into the liturgy of the prayer. And yet, despite lacking these hallmarks, it is included right in the general sutra section of the Kangyur.
The Kangyur being the translated words of the Buddha.
Yes. And this is highly unusual. Normally, texts that are purely dedications and aspirations are housed elsewhere. As the 84,000 introduction points out, we would typically expect to find such texts in sections designated specifically for them, such as at the very end of the main tantra collection, or tucked at the end of the compendium of Dharanis.
So, what does this all mean? Why is this text, bereft of the usual "thus did I hear" narrative framing, placed so prominently within the general sutra section?
To answer that, we have to look at the different historical editions of the Kangyur. In the editions known as the Shelpa Kangyurs, this text, along with a sister text titled The Dedication Protecting Beings, is placed at the very end of the Mahayana division of the general sutra section. In another tradition, the Thampangma Kangyurs, they are placed toward the end of the entire general sutra section.
Okay.
Their function is reflected in this precise, deliberate placement. They serve as a seal.
A seal. Oh, wow. The visual of that is incredibly potent, like sealing a letter or sealing a container so nothing leaks out.
That is exactly the mechanism at play. In the Shalpa Kangyurs, these two texts appear to be dedications meant specifically to seal the profound sections of the Mahayana Sutras. Imagine the journey of a practitioner. You read through these vast, mind-expanding discourses of the Mahayana. You accumulate an immense amount of spiritual merit simply by studying and contemplating that holy Dharma.
Right.
But merit, if left undirected, can dissipate. So you reach the end of the collection, you arrive at this text, and it acts to gather all of that accumulated energy and seal it with a perfect, unified dedication.
It functions like a magnificent standalone epilogue. It pulls together the kinetic energy of an entire epic library of wisdom and focuses it like a laser toward a single purpose.
Beautifully said.
But this structural anomaly, the fact that it acts as this grand seal yet lacks the traditional narrative opening, this caught the attention of historical scholars, didn't it? They noticed it didn't quite fit the mold.
Yes, they certainly did. Specifically, we can look at the work of the 15th century scholar Pikar Sangpo. He was a meticulous thinker who conducted a comprehensive analytical survey of all the sutras found in the Kangyur. When he analyzed this specific text, he concluded that because it lacks those distinguishing narrative features, the setting, the audience, the "thus did I hear," it must actually be an extract.
An extract, like pulled from something else.
Exactly. He posited that it was pulled from another, much longer, and perhaps lost sutra.
Wait, really? Were they ever able to find the master document the longer sutra belonged to?
No. The researchers at 84,000 note that a thorough search for matches within the vast Tibetan corpus has not yet identified any longer text that this might belong to. It remains a beautiful mystery. Interestingly, in his analysis, Pikar Sangpo also characterized this text as a teaching of the third turning.
The third turning of the wheel of Dharma. For you, the listener, that implies a very specific, highly developed level of Buddhist philosophy. It deals deeply with the ultimate nature of reality, and specifically with the concept of Buddha nature, the inherent potential for awakening that resides within every single sentient being.
Right.
And we know this text, whatever its origin, is incredibly ancient. The 84,000 introduction tells us that even though there is no surviving Sanskrit original, we can say with a reasonable degree of confidence that it was translated into Tibetan in the early 9th century.
We can trace it back that far because it appears in the ancient imperial catalogs of translated texts. Specifically, it is listed in both the Dhenkarma and the Fengthangma catalogs. These are foundational records of the early translation period in Tibet.
Okay.
In the Fengthema catalog, the text's length is even precisely noted. It is recorded as being 50 shlokas or stanzas long. This means practitioners have been revering, reciting, and preserving these exact 50 stanzas for well over a millennium.
That is just staggering to think about. So now that we understand the geography of the text, where it lives in the canon, and its vital role as a seal for the Mahayana teachings, we need to examine its internal architecture. We need to look at how the prayer itself is built, because the structure of this text is not arbitrary. The structure is a map of Mahayana Buddhist practice in miniature.
Exactly. Let us examine the liturgy itself. The 84,000 introduction astutely points out that the structure of this text partly reflects a very famous framework known as the Liturgy of the Seven Branches, or the Seven Limbs. In Tibetan, this is known as Yanlag Dunpa. The seven-limb practice is the bedrock structure for countless Mahayana and Vajrayana Buddhist prayers, sadhanas, and daily pujas.
Let's lay out those seven branches so you, the listener, have the complete map in your mind before we see how this text alters it. The seven traditional branches are, first, prostration or homage, second, offering, third, confession of faults, fourth, rejoicing in the virtue of others, fifth, requesting the Buddhas to turn the wheel of Dharma or to teach, sixth, requesting the Buddhas not to pass into final nirvana, and seventh, the dedication of merit.
What's fascinating here is the unique compression we see at work in this specific text. It does not neatly, symmetrically walk through all seven branches like a standard checklist. The introduction highlights this as a significant structural anomaly. It suggests two possibilities. Perhaps the formalized, rigid set of seven branches was only standardized later in Buddhist history, after this text was composed. Or, perhaps more compellingly, this text deliberately and masterfully isolates and amplifies two specific movements to create a very particular spiritual pressure.
Right, because when we look at the text, some branches are minimized to almost nothing and others are entirely absent. Let's look at homage. There is only a single fleeting line of homage at the very beginning. The text simply reads, "I bow my head at the feet of all the Buddhas, to the teaching, and to the assembly of fully ordained monks."
That is the entirety of the first branch.
Yeah. And then we come to the second branch offering. We look for the beautiful verses describing the offering of flowers, incense, and light, but offering is not mentioned at all. It's completely skipped.
Instead of a balanced seven-part harmony, the body of the text radically compresses the practice into two heavily detailed, massive main sections. The first section is devoted entirely, exhaustively, to confession. The second section is devoted to rejoicing, which then flows into requesting to teach, requesting to remain, and culminates in a vast dedication.
The way I conceptualize this compression is that the text is deliberately isolating the two most crucial, heavy-lifting mechanical actions of spiritual transformation. It focuses entirely on clearing the vessel and then pouring out the gold.
I love that analogy.
You simply cannot fill a vessel that is already brimming with impurities and stagnant water. The confession is the arduous process of scrubbing the vessel clean. And then the dedication, which is fueled by the immense joy of rejoicing, is the pouring out of the pure gold of merit for the absolute benefit of all beings.
That captures the dynamic perfectly. The division into these two massive, detailed parts emphasizes the distinguishing psychological feature of this prayer. It is uncompromising. It demands profound, unblinking self-reflection before it allows a practitioner to experience the expansiveness and relief of dedication. It forces you to look at the darkness before you distribute the light.
So let us step directly into that first movement. We are entering the deep mechanics of confession found early in the text. The prayer begins its actual work not with lofty, beautiful aspirations for world peace, but with a radical, sweeping, almost painfully comprehensive confession.
Yes.
The underlying logic is clear. To fulfill all aspirations, one must first dismantle the obstacles they themselves have created.
The language used here is meticulously designed to leave absolutely no stone unturned. The ego is given nowhere to hide. The text reads, "Whatever sins and non-virtuous actions I have committed and accumulated from cyclic existence's undiscoverable beginning, in this life and in other lives, as a householder and as a renunciant." Let us pause and examine the sheer scale of that opening.
From cyclic existence's undiscoverable beginning. That phrasing immediately shatters our normal perception of time and consequence. We are not just sitting down to apologize for the mistakes we made yesterday, or even the deep regrets of our current adulthood.
Right. We are being asked to address the entirety of an infinite karmic chain. The glossary defines this cyclic existence as korba, the Tibetan term for samsara. It is the endless, churning cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. The text is demanding that the practitioner take absolute accountability for a chain of causality so ancient, so unfathomably long, that its beginning cannot even be discovered.
And it ensures that no mode of existence is exempt. It says, as a householder and as a renunciant. This means whether you were living an ordinary worldly life tangled in business and family in the past, or whether you had taken strict vows and lived as a monk or nun, the accumulation of non-virtue occurred.
There is no escape clause.
None. The text then categorizes the methodology of these actions, what I have done physically, verbally, and mentally. Action, speech, and thought. The three doors through which we interact with and shape reality. If we steal, that is physical. If we lie, that is verbal. If we harbor deep malice, that is mental. But here's where it gets really interesting and honestly profoundly challenging. The text doesn't stop at our direct intentional actions. It pushes further into the shadows.
It does.
It says we must confess what I have exhorted others to do and what I have rejoiced in others doing, what I have done knowingly or unknowingly, intentionally or unintentionally, and what I have remembered or forgotten.
This specific passage requires our deepest, most careful examination. It reveals the profound psychology of complicity in Buddhism. Karma is not merely about what your hands have physically wrought in the world. It is, at its very core, about the alignment of your mind.
Okay, I have to offer some pushback here on behalf of the listener because this challenges our modern legalistic sense of morality.
So,
it is one thing to confess what you did on purpose. If I lied to someone knowingly to get an advantage, I can own that. I generated that harm. But why in the world must we confess what we did unintentionally or what we did unknowingly? And furthermore, why must I confess what I merely rejoiced in someone else doing? If I didn't actually commit the act, if my hands are clean, why is the heavy burden of confession being placed upon my shoulders?
This raises an important question, perhaps the most important question, regarding the nature of karma and the subtle conditioning of the mind. The word karma translates simply as action, but its engine is intention. When you observe a harmful act committed by another person, say, someone you dislike being ruined, and you experience a spark of joy, you are rejoicing in harm. When you do that, you are actively aligning your own mental continuum with that destructive energy. You are planting the energetic seed of that non-virtue directly into your own mind. You are watering it with your approval. To rejoice in harm is to energetically and karmically participate in it.
I see the mechanism now. Even if I didn't strike the blow, by celebrating it, I am conditioning my own mind to be receptive to striking that blow myself in the future. I am degrading my own compassion.
Precisely. You are eroding your own boundaries against non-virtue. Now, regarding your question about unintentional or unknowing actions, it is true that the immediate karmic weight of a purely accidental act is different from a cold, premeditated one. However, an unwholesome action, even if blind, still leaves a trace.
Right.
It still creates friction and suffering in the world, and it still subtly obscures the mind of the doer. By confessing the unintentional, we are doing something incredibly profound. We are acknowledging our deep foundational ignorance. We are admitting our fundamental clumsiness as we stumble through cyclic existence.
That is beautifully put. Fundamental clumsiness.
We are saying, my lack of awareness, my sleepwalking through life has caused harm, even when I did not mean to. It is the ultimate taking of responsibility, dropping the defense of, I didn't mean it.
It entirely removes the excuse of ignorance. Speaking of ignorance, the text then systematically lists the root causes of all these actions we are confessing. It states we must confess. What I have done under the influence of desire, under the influence of anger, under the influence of ignorance.
These three forces, desire, anger, and ignorance, are universally known in Buddhist terminology as the three poisons. In Tibetan, they are dagsum. If we consult the glossary, it also refers to them as the primary afflictions, or nyan mungspa.
The root of all of it.
Exactly. They are the fundamental, distorting emotional states that bind an individual to the suffering of cyclic existence. Every single non-virtuous action the text is demanding we confess stems from one of these three roots. Ignorance is the fundamental misapprehension of reality. From that blindness, we grasp out of desire, trying to pull things toward us to make us whole, or we strike out in anger, trying to violently push away the things that threaten us.
The confession then continues, moving from those philosophical roots into an incredibly detailed, granular breakdown of ethics. The practitioner must confess to violations of proper ethic, violations of ethical rules, and violations of natural ethics. I want to lean heavily on the 84,000 notes here because the distinction between these types of ethics is fascinating and crucial to understanding the breadth of the confession.
Yes, note number 6 in the translation provides vital, clarifying context for these terms. It defines two very specific, distinct categories of unwholesome actions or faults. The Tibetan word for fault here is ka namathobai, which literally translates to something unmentionable.
Unmentionable. Yeah. Wow. Let's break down those two categories so we understand exactly what we're confessing. The first is violations of ethical rules. The Tibetan term provided is spior bas chul krims chalpa. What exactly falls into this category?
These are actions that are considered unwholesome specifically, and only because they violate a precept or a rule that was established by the Buddha. A rule to which a specific individual has voluntarily committed themselves. These are formally called faults related to rules, or bikaspayaka namatopa.
Okay, give me an example of that.
The 84,000 notes give a perfect classic example. Eating afternoon. For a fully ordained monka bhiksu, who the glossary notes observes an astonishing 253 Vinaya vows in the Tibetan tradition, eating a meal after the sun passes its zenith is strictly forbidden by their vows. Therefore, doing so is a violation of ethical rules.
Right.
However, eating afternoon is not an inherently evil act. It is perfectly allowed and morally neutral for lay people.
So that category is about breaking a specific contract or vow you made. It is about a breach of spiritual discipline. But the second category is much heavier. It is violations of natural ethics. The Tibetan phrase is jingos postura krims chalpa.
Yes. These are actions that are described as inherently unwholesome faults, or rangbizningika namathopa. These are actions like killing a living being, stealing what is not freely given, or speaking vicious lies. These actions are inherently objectively destructive to oneself and to others, regardless of whether you have taken a vow against them or not.
They apply universally.
Across the board. To lay people and monastics alike. The power of this confession is that it leaves absolutely no room for evasion. You must confess breaking your specific chosen vows, and you must equally confess the inherent, universal moral failings common to all confused beings.
And the scope of the confession just keeps expanding outward. It includes faults engaged in toward the most sacred objects, the Buddha, the holy teaching, the assembly of practitioners. It includes faults toward one's parents, abbots, and spiritual masters. It categorizes them as the 3 kinds of physical wrongdoing, the 4 kinds of verbal wrongdoing, and the 3 kinds of mental wrongdoing.
It is exhaustive.
It is. And it doesn't stop at outward actions. It dives into incredibly subtle, almost imperceptible internal failings. Listen to the psychological precision of this passage. That, clouded by whichever obscurations, I gave rise to non-virtuous qualities and did not establish my mind properly in virtue, that, clouded by other obscurations, I was distracted and mentally agitated. All such faults, I confess.
It demands a level of internal honesty that is almost painful to sustain, but is ultimately profoundly liberating. The text is methodically cornering the ego. It systematically removes every single shadow, every justification, every excuse the ego might try to hide within. It forces the practitioner to stand in the harsh light and say, in whatever ways I was childish, in whatever ways foolish, in whatever ways confused, in whatever ways unwise, and in whatever ways misguided, all such faults I confess as faults.
That specific phrasing strikes me deeply. I confess as faults. It entirely removes the narrative of justification. It removes the comforting story we constantly tell ourselves about why we were angry or why we were distracted or why we had to lie just that one time.
Yes, the I had a good reason narrative.
Exactly. It strips all the narrative padding away and just leaves the bare, unadorned acknowledgement of the flaw itself. And then, once the vessel is empty, comes the vow, the absolute pivot toward transformation. Having confessed those faults as faults, I vow that in the future, I will not act in such ways again.
That sequence is vital. Acknowledgement is the absolute non-negotiable prerequisite for transformation. Without first bringing the fault fully into the light of conscious awareness, the vow not to repeat it has no soil to root in. It is just empty words.
And to permanently seal this incredible, grueling movement of the mind, we see the refrain. We must remember that this text is a liturgy. It is designed to be spoken aloud, and it utilizes the hypnotic, penetrating power of ritual repetition. The text simply states at the end of this section, thus I recite a second time, and thus a third time.
Yes.
The practitioner is instructed to go through this entire, exhaustive, devastating inventory of the soul, not just once, but 3 full times.
The repetition ensures that the confession does not remain a merely intellectual exercise. By repeating it 3 times, the words begin to bypass the intellect and penetrate the deep, stubborn layers of defense we have spent lifetimes building around our self-image. It truly, thoroughly clears the vessel.
So the vessel is now finally clear. All the stagnant water has been emptied. We now transition to the second major movement of our deep dive, the radical act of rejoicing. Once the mind is cleared through this exhaustive, painful confession, how does it begin to accumulate good? How does it begin to gather the immense spiritual energy needed to actually fulfill all aspirations?
If we connect this to the bigger picture of Mahayana Buddhist practice, we must understand that the accumulation of vast merit doesn't happen solely through physical action. Physical action is inherently limited by our bodies, our resources, and our circumstances. You can only give away so much wealth. You can only physically help so many people in a day.
Right, there's a ceiling to it.
But the mind? The mind is absolutely boundless. Therefore, the most powerful exponential way to accumulate merit is by looking outward and experiencing pure, uncontrived joy at the virtue of others.
Rejoicing, the practice of mudita. The text asks the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to pay heed to the practitioner once again, and then it launches into this ecstatic, soaring litany of joy. It starts at the very pinnacle, the absolute summit of spiritual achievement. It rejoices in the awakened ones. The text says, "I rejoice that all the Buddhas who formerly were Bodhisattvas completely accomplished the six perfections." Let's clearly define those six perfections for the listener, because they are the very DNA of this spiritual path.
The six perfections, or Pharal Tu Phikon Phrag in Tibetan, are the specific sustained practices that lead a being to unexcelled, perfect, complete enlightenment. The text lists them explicitly, and we should sit with each one.
Let's do that.
They attained awakening by means of generosity. The complete willingness to give one's wealth, body, and the Dharma without hesitation. By ethical discipline, the flawless conduct that harms no one. By endurance, the profound patience to bear hardships and the harms inflicted by others without anger.
That endurance is so difficult.
It is. And then by diligence, the joyful, untiring effort in doing good. By meditative absorption, the unwavering concentration of the mind, and finally, by wisdom, the direct realization of the ultimate nature of reality, of emptiness.
And we, as the reciters of the prayer, rejoice that they did this. We experience joy that they successfully navigated that arduous path. We rejoice that they turned the wheel of the Dharma, blew the conch of the Dharma, beat the drum of the Dharma, and set ablaze the lamp of the Dharma. We are literally celebrating the fact that enlightenment is not a myth. It is possible, it has been achieved, and the teachings to reach it exist right now in the world.
The rejoicing then extends outward to other highly realized beings. It rejoices in the roots of virtue of the Pratika Buddhas. These are solitary realizers, those who achieve the state of awakening independently without a teacher in their final life, and the Sravakas, the foundational disciples who listen to the teachings of a Buddha. The text specifically rejoices that they realized the three knowledges and the six super knowledges.
Six super knowledges. In Tibetan, Mununan Par Sheza Pa Drug, and in Sanskrit, Sadatijna. The glossary provides a magnificent, detailed definition of these six modes of supernormal cognition. Let's walk through them carefully, because this is exactly what the practitioner is holding in their mind, contemplating with absolute joy.
The first five of these super knowledges are considered mundane or worldly, though they're obviously still extraordinary attainments. They are, first, clairvoyance, the divine eye to see across vast distances and realms. Second, clairaudience, the divine ear to hear all sounds and teachings.
Imagine possessing that kind of perception.
It is immense. Third, the knowledge of the minds of others, instantly knowing the thoughts and temperaments of any being. Fourth, the remembrance of past lives, seeing the infinite chain of rebirths. And fifth, the ability to perform miracles, manipulating the physical elements.
Okay, but those first five, they are mundane.
Yes. These five, the glossary carefully notes, can be attained to some extent by non-Buddhist yogis, as well as Buddhist arhats and bodhisattvas, through the sheer power of intense meditative concentration.
But the sixth super knowledge is the absolute pinnacle. It is the dividing line between cyclic existence and freedom.
Yes. The sixth is the knowledge of the complete destruction of all mental defilements. The glossary emphasizes that this is considered super mundane. It can be attained only by Buddhist yogis who have directly realized selflessness. It is the definitive, irreversible end of cyclic existence. And the text asks us to rejoice in others attaining this unimaginable freedom, even if we ourselves are still trapped in the muddy, confusing waters of samsara.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. Because it is one thing to rejoice in a Buddha attaining omniscience or an advanced yogi attaining the destruction of all mental defilements. That feels suitably grand, suitably religious for a holy text. It is easy to celebrate the distant and divine.
Right.
But the rejoicing in this text is not limited to cosmic, supernatural feats. It swoops down from the heavens and focuses with equal intensity on the mundane, the human, and the truly microscopic.
It is incredibly beautifully grounded in the reality of human suffering and happiness. The text rejoices in sentient beings completely overcoming the lower suffering realms, the infernal, agonizing realms of the hells, the realms of animals driven by instinct and fear, and the realm of the Lord of the Dead. It rejoices in their abandoning of the heavy afflictions. But then, remarkably, it rejoices in their ordinary worldly well-being.
Yes. Listen to this list. It is so human. It rejoices in their longevity, health, good complexions, excellent figures, great splendor, great power, high status, great wealth, and great wisdom.
This passage entirely dismantles a very common, very pervasive misconception about Buddhist practice. The idea that it's entirely austere, life-denying, and dismissive of ordinary worldly happiness, that is simply not true.
Exactly.
Here, the practitioner is actively, intentionally cultivating supreme joy simply because someone else happens to be healthy, or because someone else has great wealth, or even because someone else possesses a good connection. There's absolutely zero room for envy. The Buddha's cure for jealousy is not to suppress it, but to actively, aggressively rejoice in the good fortune of the very person you are jealous of.
It is the ultimate antidote to the zero-sum game we usually play in our heads, where someone else's success feels like our failure. And then the scale of the text shrinks even further. It zooms in down to the atomic level of spiritual practice. The text rejoices in even as little as a single prostration, joining the palms for prayer even a single time, the offering of a single flower, and sentient beings who give rise to just a single moment of faith.
Let us sit with that for a moment. A single flower placed on an altar. A single, fleeting moment of faith in a confused mind.
I think of the specific rejoicing practice as an open source accumulation of merit. You don't have to be the one who achieved the six perfections over three countless eons. You don't have to be the one who offered the single flower to the altar. You don't even have to be the one who experienced that brief flash of faith.
Right.
By cultivating a mind that is genuinely, supremely pleased by another person's virtue, your own mind expands to perfectly match the frequency of that virtue. You literally download the merit of the universe simply by being thrilled that the universe contains good things.
That is precisely the mechanism, and you explained it beautifully. Merit operates on the principle of non-scarcity. When you rejoice in the light of a candle, your joy doesn't diminish the candle's flame. It merely lights your own. The text underscores the required intensity of this feeling. In all of these things I rejoice. Supremely pleased I rejoice. I rejoice with rejoicing that is most excellent, supreme, best, perfect, unsurpassed, highest, pure, completely pure like the sky. The mind of the practitioner is stretched until it becomes as vast and unblemished as the open sky, capable of holding all the virtue of all beings across all time in a state of perfect, resonating celebration.
Having expanded the mind to the size of the sky through this ecstatic rejoicing, we arrive at the next crucial phase of the prayer. This is the act of exhorting the awakened to teach and remain. Recognizing the boundless good that exists in the universe naturally leads to a somewhat desperate, urgent wish that this good, this holy Dharma, continues to be accessible to all the beings who are still suffering in ignorance.
This section is fascinating because it reveals a profound vulnerability regarding the Dharma itself. Text section 1.7 specifically addresses and exhorts those beings who have fully, completely understood the Holy Dharma. It lists their incredible, awe-inspiring qualifications. They know how to delight in the Dharma, how to discern it perfectly, how to generate all roots of virtue.
The highest realized beings.
Yes. They have memorized the thousands of compilations of the Dharma. They have mastered the meditative absorptions, the liberations, the vows, and the prayers.
And the text points out, leaning on a very illuminating note from the 84,000 translation note 8, that these enlightened beings deeply, intimately understand the very people they might teach. They know beings' intentions, latent dispositions, temperament, and intrinsic nature, and understand them correctly.
Yes, we must unpack note 8 here, as it is crucial. It points out that this specific set of four terms, intentions, latent dispositions, temperament, and intrinsic nature, is a common, precise formulation found in classical Vinaya literature. The Tibetan word for intentions is bzampa, latent dispositions is baglanyal, temperament is kams, and intrinsic nature is rang bishin.
So what do those four terms tell us?
It describes the exact penetrating knowledge an awakened being uses to assess the absolute best, most effective approach for teaching an individual. They don't just lecture blindly. They see the student's past karma, their hidden fears, their capacity. The glossary also suggests a profound interpretation that intrinsic nature here is possibly a direct reference to the Buddha nature, the Tathagatagarbha. They see the dormant seed of enlightenment within the most confused person.
So to summarize, these awakened beings possess the perfect, flawless medicine, and they know exactly, flawlessly, how to administer it to every specific, unique patient. But, and this is a massive structural but in the text, the prayer says, yet who, having that understanding, also know that sentient beings do not delight in instruction, and so remain at ease, rest their minds, and do not teach the Dharma I exhort them.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this highlights one of the most sobering, unsentimental truths in all of Buddhism. Liberation cannot be forced. The Buddha, despite his infinite compassion and infinite power, cannot simply reach into your mind and switch off your ignorance if you are actively clinging to it.
Right. You have to want it.
Exactly. The awakened ones look out and see the immense suffering of the world, yes. But they also see the profound stubbornness, the deeply ingrained defensive habituation of sentient beings who, quite frankly, do not delight in instruction. Because beings fundamentally do not want to hear the truth that will dismantle their ego, the enlightened ones, entirely free from any neurotic compulsion or anxiety to save the world, simply rest at ease in their perfect realization. They rest their minds.
Which means the burden of initiating the teaching, the burden of keeping the wheel of Dharma turning, falls entirely on the student. It falls on the listener. It falls on the practitioner. We cannot passively wait for the universe to force wisdom upon us. We have to actively beg for it.
We do.
The text provides the impassioned script for this entreaty. For the benefit of the many, I entreat them to explain the holy Dharma. I entreat them to turn the wheel of the Dharma. I entreat them to blow the conch of the Dharma. I entreat them to beat the drum of the Dharma. I entreat them to set the lamp of the Dharma ablaze.
It is a profound act of taking total responsibility for the spiritual environment of the entire world. And this responsibility continues in the next section, pleading for the physical longevity of the teachers. The practitioner entreats those masters who have gained mastery over life, mastery of emanation, mastery of blessing, and mastery of miraculous power, specifically those who have completed their work and intend and enter final nirvana and forsake their current life to remain.
To stay with us.
Yes. For the benefit of the many, for the happiness of the many, I entreat them to grant the blessing of the conditions for their longevity.
We're essentially asking the highest, most weary beings to delay their final peaceful rest purely out of compassion for our muddy, confused world. And having made this desperate request, having confessed every hidden wrong, having rejoiced in all the good of the universe, and having begged for the teachings to continue, we finally arrive at the climax of the text, the ultimate generosity, the dedication of merit.
The practitioner has now generated an immense, almost unfathomable amount of spiritual energy, what the text technically calls roots of virtue. The confession cleared the vessel. The rejoicing filled it to the brim. What does the practitioner do with this vast accumulated spiritual wealth?
They give every single ounce of it away. The text begins this final movement by stating, I dedicate whatever roots of virtue I have created and accumulated from cyclic existence's undiscoverable beginning. Let's pause to clearly define roots of virtue.
The text is meticulous, mentioning the dedication of both mundane and transcendent roots of virtue. Note 9 in the translation is very helpful in parsing this distinction. It explains the Tibetan phrase, Jigrit Dang, Jigrit Lasgadis Pai Jibai Ritsaba.
What is the difference?
Mundane roots of virtue are the wholesome actions, the good deeds, and the accumulated merit gathered on the paths of ordinary beings who are still operating within the world of cyclic existence. Transcendent roots of virtue, however, are those profound merits gathered on the world-transcending paths of the noble ones. Those beings who have achieved direct, unmediated realization of the ultimate nature of reality.
So we are talking about every single good deed, every quiet moment of meditation, every ounce of ethical discipline, whether ordinary or exalted, accumulated over countless infinite lifetimes, all of it is gathered up. Even causing just a single sentient being to give rise to a single moment of faith, the text says, ensuring nothing is left out. And the practitioner boldly declares, all of these I dedicate to all sentient beings. By these roots of virtue, may all the roots of virtue of all sentient beings be completely perfected.
And we must ask, what exactly are we dedicating this merit toward? What is the specific aspiration? The list provided in the text is breathtaking in its comprehensive, uncompromising scope. It perfectly mirrors the rejoicing section by moving from the necessary worldly comforts to the ultimate spiritual summits.
It begins by wishing for beings to simply have long life, health, good complexions, protective magic spells, and medicine. It wishes for them to overcome the suffering of the lower realms and entirely overcome physical and mental unhappiness. But then it rapidly ascends to the absolute pinnacles of enlightenment. The text wishes for all beings to attain the excellence of the enlightened attributes of the Sravakas, the excellence of the enlightened attributes of the Pratika Buddhas.
And then it invokes the specific, supreme, unimaginable qualities of a fully awakened Buddha. It dedicates all merit so that every single being may attain the 10 powers of the Tathagatas.
Let's deeply explore this list of the 10 powers. We won't just list them. Let's think about what they actually mean. According to the 84,000 glossary, the 10 powers define the state of omniscience. The first is knowing what is possible and what is impossible. Imagine the clarity of moving through reality without ever holding a false hope or an irrational fear, perfectly understanding the physical and karmic laws of the universe.
It is absolute clarity. The second is knowing the results of actions, or the ripening of karma. This is staggering to contemplate. It means possessing the infinite calculation required to see the endless ripple effect of every single action, word, and thought across the tapestry of time, knowing exactly how a harsh word spoken today will ripen in 1,000 lifetimes.
Wow. The third is knowing the various inclinations of sentient beings, understanding the deep, hidden desires that drive people. The fourth is knowing the various elements, the fundamental makeup of reality. The fifth is knowing the supreme and lesser faculties of sentient beings, knowing exactly who is ready to learn what and when.
The sixth power is knowing the paths that lead to all destinations of rebirth. The seventh is the complete mastery and knowledge of all concentrations, liberations, absorptions, equilibriums, afflictions, purifications, and abidings. This is the absolute mastery of every possible state of consciousness.
The eighth is knowing previous lives, an infinite unbroken memory. The ninth is knowing the death and rebirth of all sentient beings, seeing the great wheel turn in its entirety. And the tenth, the culmination, is knowing the cessation of the defilements, the ultimate end of all suffering.
We are dedicating our hard-won merit so that every single being in existence, including our enemies, attains that exact, exhaustive level of supreme godlike knowledge. The text also lists the 4 states of fearlessness, the 18 distinctive qualities of a Buddha, and the 4 discernments, which the glossary notes means correct and entirely unhindered discriminating knowledge.
It even lists these highly esoteric poetic states of realization. Dedicating merit so beings attain the state of the sky treasury, the state of the jewel holder, and the unsurpassed wisdom of omniscience. Every single possible spiritual summit is wished upon all other beings.
Yes. It is the uncompromising wish for the complete perfection of all life.
Okay, I have to play the skeptic here for a moment. Yeah. I have to ask the logical question. This all sounds beautiful, obviously. It sounds incredibly noble. But logically, if I take every single root of virtue I have painstakingly accumulated since the beginningless beginning of cyclic existence, and I just give it all away to other sentient beings, do I not empty my own spiritual bank account? The title of this text is Fulfilling All Aspirations. How does giving away all my merit fulfill my aspirations for enlightenment? It seems like spiritual bankruptcy.
This raises an important question, perhaps the single most important philosophical question in the entire Mahayana tradition. It touches on the ultimate, beautiful paradox of the Bodhisattva path. If you hoard your merit, if you view your roots of virtue as personal property to be safely kept in a spiritual bank account for your own exclusive eventual liberation, you are still operating from a fundamental framework of ego and separation.
Ah, you were still grasping.
Exactly, you were still grasping. And grasping, as we learned in the grueling confession section, is rooted in desire and ignorance, the primary afflictions. Clinging to merit, shooting it as a possession, actually turns the merit itself into a poison.
So the very act of trying to selfishly keep my virtue is the exact mechanism that prevents me from reaching the ultimate virtue.
Exactly. By dedicating it entirely to others. By sincerely, fiercely generating the wish found at the end of the text. May I ferry those sentient beings across who have not crossed over. May I liberate those who are not yet liberated. May I give relief to those who are unrelieved. And may I establish them in the realm of ultimate benefit and bliss. By doing this, the practitioner completely shatters the illusion of a separate self.
It destroys the ego.
Yes. The mind aligns perfectly with the awakened state itself, which is nothing but boundless compassion and emptiness. The dedication is the vehicle of awakening, You fulfill your own highest aspiration precisely by completely, utterly abandoning it for the sake of others. You become as vast as the sky by giving everything to the sky.
The text then seals this majestic, ego-destroying act of generosity with the exact same ritual refrain we saw after the confession. Thus I recite a second time, and thus a third time. We must give it all away, over and over and over again, until the deep, instinctual habit of giving permanently replaces the ancient habit of grasping.
It is a flawless spiritual mechanism, but by repeatedly emptying yourself, you become full.
As we draw this deep dive to a close, let's look back at the extraordinary journey we've taken through this text. We explored a work that mysteriously lacks the traditional narrative markers of a sutra, a profound text that the ancient Shalpa Kangyurs used specifically to seal the boundless teachings of the Mahayana.
We observed its unique, highly compressed architecture, taking the traditional seven limbs of practice and distilling them into two massive, unyielding movements of purification and generosity.
We witnessed the deep, grueling mechanics of confession, a practice demanding radical accountability for every physical action, spoken word, and hidden thought, even those done entirely unintentionally, or those we merely rejoiced in from afar, stretching all the way back to an undiscoverable beginning.
And we experienced the radical act of rejoicing, where the mind forcefully expands to match the virtues of all beings, ranging from the unimaginable attainment of the 10 powers of the Tathagatas all the way down to the simplest, most mundane health and happiness of an ordinary being.
We saw how the practitioner must actively, desperately entreat the awakened ones to teach, recognizing the sobering truth that liberation cannot be forced upon those who do not wish to hear the instruction. And finally, we arrived at the ultimate generosity, the complete, fearless surrender and dedication of all personal roots of virtue for the ultimate benefit and bliss of all life.
I want to remind the listener that what we have explored today is not merely ancient religious history or dry, abstract philosophy. It is a highly refined technology for the mind, available to you right now. Studying the Dharma together as we have done during this hour is a wonderful accumulation of merit, but it must ultimately transition into aspiration and dedication to truly transform us. We must apply the seal to our own practice.
We started this deep dive talking about the diagnostic muddy waters of the human mind and the profound difficulty of finding a clean, clear x-ray of our own suffering. The dedication fulfilling all aspirations offers us an entirely different kind of clarity. It doesn't ask us to surgically, clinically extract our flaws. It asks us to confess them boldly into the light and then dissolve them completely in the vast sky-like expanse of rejoicing in the good of others.
Right.
I want to leave you, the listener, with a final lingering thought to mull over as you transition back into the flow of your day. We heard today that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, in their infinite omniscient wisdom, find supreme, unmatched joy in something as incredibly small as the offering of a single flower or a single fleeting moment of faith. The entire universe literally celebrates that tiny spark of virtue.
Yes.
So as you go about your mundane modern life today, as you are navigating traffic, answering mundane emails, or just walking through your neighborhood, what tiny, seemingly insignificant roots of virtue are blooming around you right now, just waiting for you to notice and actively rejoice in them?
A profound question to carry forward into the world.
Thank you for joining us in this space, for slowing down your pace to walk with these ancient words, and for taking this deep dive into the Dharma with us today. May all your aspirations be fulfilled.
Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts from bodyarchive.org.